Okay. All right. Last week we got started in the introductory part of Revelation, and my plan is for us to finish that introductory part tonight and maybe get into chapter 1, I hope. But last time I found myself racing the clock, and I'm going to try really hard not to race the clock anymore. But anyway, last time we were on this page, and since we had just a few minutes left, I asked you to zip down to number 4 in terms of rules for interpreting Revelation and consider the impact of pagan idolatry on the Roman Empire. And as you recall, there are 24 passages, at least, could be more, so I might have missed some, but there are at least 24 passages in the New Testament in 10 books where idolatry is condemned or spoken of harshly. And as I mentioned last week, I have underestimated that, because we tend to have no problem with idolatry here. We have generalized it. Preachers generalize it to things that we value too highly, cars and jobs and so forth, which is appropriate. However, in the first century, idolatry was a huge issue. So last week, we got through, if you look at that page that I gave you on New Testament scriptures concerning idolatry, we got down through about 2/3 of them. But let's start and finish those, because the last 5 of them are in Revelation. And I think it's really important for us to understand the impact of idolatry on the Roman Empire in the first century and second century for that matter, because I really think it does impact on what we think Revelation means. At least it impacts what I think it means. So let's go down to 1 Thessalonians 1:9. It says, we won't turn to all these, but I've paraphrased what they say. Paul speaks of how the Thessalonians turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God. In 1 Peter 4:3, Peter groups abominable idolatries with those pursuing a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousals, and drinking parties, many of which were associated with pagan idolatry. I mean, the devil is so smart. And what he did was he put a lot of these sexual activities and carousal activities and various things into pagan idolatry, which technically is a religion. And think of how easy it is to salve your conscience if you're thinking, well, my religion is idolatry and worshiping this, what we know as a false god. And part of that, when I go to the temple, is engage with the temple sexual prostitutes and the carousals and all the things that go along with that. And it's all part of my religion. What a convenient religion. So the devil was going wild on that one. Then we come down to 1 John, of course, who wrote Revelation. And in 1 John 5:21, he says, little children, guard yourselves from idols. And then we start 5 scriptures in Revelation, and we see they go from the beginning nearly to the end. In 2:14, he talks about Balak put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit acts of immorality. Again, those things are associated. In 2:20, he mentioned Jezebel leads my bondservants astray, so that they commit acts of immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols. Again, those go together. 9:20, it says, evil men did not repent so as not to worship demons and the idols of gold and silver and of brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. Then we get very harsh in 21:8, for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So look at what idolaters are connected with in that passage. Murderers, immoral persons, sorcerers and liars and idolaters. And their eternal outcome is said there. And then finally in 22:15, outside the gates of the holy city are the dogs and sorcerers and the immoral persons and the murderers and the idolaters and everyone who loves and practices lying. So clearly, pagan idolatry in first century Rome and second century Rome for that matter was a very big issue. And I want to try to get across to you how big that was, because with Domitian, when he started, you know, Domitian, I told you, reigned from 81 to 96, and he started out okay as an emperor, and he began to lose it emotionally, mentally, for some reason, and started getting worse and worse, and was paranoid. And sometime in the 90s, between 91 and 96, which is when a lot of people think Revelation was written, Domitian just started really going nuts with persecuting Christians. And he really got into being worshipped as a god. In fact, he didn't just like it, he demanded it. And so people who lived in the Roman Empire were forced to confess their faith in Domitian as a god, or else be punished in some way, sometimes killed, sometimes exiled, sometimes with various other ways. And also, idolatry was so strong in the empire that people had to actually have, they're not sure exactly how this happened, but had to have some kind of a token that they had tasted meat offered to idols and that they worshipped Domitian as a god. And it's what our version of it is what I'd call a business license. And it was so bad that if people did not have that, then other people who had it would not do business with them. Well, where'd that put Christians? Well, obviously in a tough spot. So there were a lot of Christians who were told, either admit that Domitian is a god and you worship him and renounce your faith in Jesus Christ, or suffer the consequences. So a lot of Christians renounced their faith in Jesus to stay alive. Others did not, and they were killed. So it was a huge issue going on back then. So it wasn't just like, you know, try to stay faithful. It was you be faithful and keep your faith in Jesus and admit that you have your faith in Jesus and face death. That's what was going on. Okay, now I really want us to consider all these things, because what these things do as introductory things is it prevents us from going off on what I'd call wacko trails on interpreting Revelation. There are a bunch of interpretations of Revelation that really don't make much sense. They're kind of wild things. So whatever we come up with on what Revelation means, these things must be taken into account. The first one, it must be consistent with the teaching of the rest of the New Testament. There are several, that should be an obvious one to all of us, because we believe obviously the rest of the New Testament. But if there's any interpretation about the book of Revelation that contradicts something else that's said in the New Testament, obviously that interpretation is wrong. And some of those interpretations, I've tried to think of examples. One of them that kind of comes to mind is there are several times in the book of Revelation where people think it's talking about the final judgment. And yet, in those areas in Revelation, there are still people left after this judgment. Well, that's not what's going to happen. Jesus tells us in Matthew that the time is going to come when, in the judgment day, there's going to be the people on the left, there's going to be the people on the right, and that's it. And there is no such thing as saying, wait a minute, I'm going to repent and believe. 2 Corinthians 5:10, Paul tells us that we're all going to give an account for what we've done, the deeds in this body, whether it's good or whether it's bad. And Peter also tells us in his epistles that at the final end, the earth elements are going to be burned up and gone. So there is no repenting there at the last minute to say, oops, I made a mistake. I think I'm going to be a Christian after all. There's going to come a time when it's too late. So that's one contradiction. There are others, as we go through Revelation, that you'll see contradict what the rest of the New Testament says. Okay, if there's a contradiction, obviously it's wrong. It must also be consistent with the prophecies of the Old Testament. And John really fits in very nicely the whole style of the way he received the visions, the way the language was presented to him, and all of that fits in very, very nicely with the way Old Testament prophets receive their revelations as well. It's a very comparable process, it appears to me. Now, it's interesting that in order to enhance our understanding of what's going on in Revelation, we really need to go back and be familiar with some of the Old Testament prophecies. Daniel, of course, comes to mind, and Zechariah comes to mind, and Ezekiel comes to mind. Those three are all apocryphal books. And you'll find that even though there are things in Revelation that seem to have a real relationship with similar things that were said in the Old Testament, there is no Old Testament prophecy that is quoted in Revelation. Some of these things bring, for people who are Old Testament scholars, you read some of these things in Revelation and you think, wow, that sounds just like, for example, what Daniel said when he saw that robot looking like man made out of four empires. Sounds a whole lot like that. And yet those things are not quoted, but they sure bring things to mind. So if we understand what the Old Testament prophets were prophesying about, then it helps us understand maybe how to view what John had to say about similar episodes in Revelation. I don't know if that's clear or just muddying up the water, but it's true. And maybe as we go through it, that'll make more sense to you as we hit those things. Also, this book was written to first century Christians. And the first century Christians didn't hear the letter read, for example, to the Christians in Ephesus. And the letter was read to them and they go, wow, we don't understand that. I mean, they got it. And I think the Christians in Smyrna and Ephesus and Thyatira and the other places, they clearly understood what the meaning of that was. They probably had a much better understanding of it than we do because they were living it. So when we consider the interpretation of the book, we've got to consider, what did this mean to those people in the first century, Christians? So what we say is, has to be something that was relevant to things that were happening at the time that John wrote it, at the end of the first century. Then we talked about pagan idolatry. And then finally, this one, at first I didn't think this one was such a big deal, but I really do think it is. We need to acknowledge that the language of the book is figurative. These are visions. They're figurative. They're apocalyptic, which means lots of symbols and lots of strange things, and there are beasts that come out of the sea, and there's another beast that comes out of the land, and there's dragons, and there's all this stuff. The language of the book is figurative, and some symbols or numbers, now here's what we need to avoid. Some symbols or numbers should not be interpreted literally, while others are interpreted figuratively. Now, why do I say that? Well, because if you listen to some of the guys on the television and the radio, they got some wonderful theories about what's going to happen based on some passage they quoted out of Revelation. And of course, most people in their audience, they don't know much about Revelation, and they're counting on what this guy tells them as being the truth. So they're all nodding. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it's about to happen. The end of the world is going to come, you know, next year. I still remember, speaking of that, I remember back in about 1986, I believe it was, a book came out, 88 Reasons Why the World's Going to End in 1988. Any of you see that? Saw that one?
I remember the talk about it.
Yeah. I read the book because I wanted to know, well, you know, should I move my bank account around or something? Anyway, 88 reasons why the world's going to end in 1988, and here we are. What's that? 12 and 22. We're 34 years later, and we're still here. Isn't that interesting? Well, anyway, there's all these crazy theories, and what people want to do is they want to take some numbers or something else in Revelation and make that literal, and then they want to take other numbers and make those figurative. Well, you can't do that. I mean, on what basis do you make the determination that this one we take real for real and this one we think, well, that's symbolic? You know, one of the numbers that comes to mind is 3.5 years. You know, 3.5 years is a key period of time in the book of Revelation. In some places, it's called 1260 days, which is about 3.5 years. In another place, and in Daniel, it's called a time, times, and a half time, which is 3.5. And in other places, it's called 3.5 years. Well, nobody knows of anything relevant scripturally back through history that happened in 3.5 years that deserves this kind of attention to have special mention made of it in the book of Revelation. There is just nothing like that happened in 3.5 years. So the 3.5 years is symbolic. It represents something, but it doesn't represent 3.5 years. If it does represent 3.5 years, we don't know which 3.5 years it was. So we've got to be careful. You know, another one is the 1,000 years. The premillennial folks, you know, take that very literally. Another number that some people take literally is the 144,000 who are going to be saved. Well, if that's the case, then we ought to start counting up Christians that have been saved and see whether or not we have a chance. So, Revelation is figurative. And we've got to be very careful not to say, well, this one's for real and this one's figurative. It said it's going to last a week. It's going to be 70 weeks. It's going to be whatever it is. And we start looking for 70-week periods when something happened. It's just not the case. Anybody have any comments about that?
I have a feeling that a couple of 1,000 years, I think that 144,000 has probably already been reached. So
I believe it has. So are we wasting our time?
Exactly. Well, you know, a lot of this 1,000-year rain coming to the mountaintop because Thursday is going to happen and Armageddon. Look at Russia and look at these other countries lining up on the desert out there. And people that are sucked into that, and I say that kindly because some of them don't understand the Bible like we try to, that it creates a religious movement away from the Bible.
Yes, it does. Are you aware, by the way, that there is an element, a subset of psychology that studies what's called doomsday cults? There's a whole series of psychology studies that study doomsday cults. And some of them are really famous. This has been going on for years, maybe centuries, I don't know. But, I mean, there wasn't any psychology back in 1534, so we don't know about those doomsday cults. But there have been a bunch of doomsday cults back in the last 150 and 200 years that psychologists have studied, and they all have a lot of things in common. You know, the biggest thing they have in common is they're baloney, because here we all still are.
What was that one that the meteorite was going to close by, fly over America, and all those
yes.
people took something?
Well, people killed themselves because they thought it's about over.
So they could ride on it, their spirits could ride on it.
Yeah, now that one was just 8 or 10 years ago, wasn't it?
The
rocket ship thing.
Yeah. It was 96.
96?
Yeah, not quite 8 years.
Yeah. Well, another one that's infamous that you'll read about, just get in your computer and punch in the number 666. You want about 250 articles of reading on 666? 666, they've tried to figure out mathematically, that means Nero. It also meant Domitian. It also meant Hitler. It was Khrushchev. It was the Pope. It's been all kinds of stuff. And everybody says, oh, I got 666 figured out. But we've got 15 different versions of who it is. So 666, I'll just tell you ahead of time, is representative of something.
A lot of people became wealthy off the thousand-year reign because of the books and the meetings, religious meetings that were held. And Satan's was just jumping up and down because they were taken away from the study of the Bible, in my opinion.
Yeah. And by the way, there was some household product. I mean, a very common household cleaning product put out by somebody that does all these products and makes zillions of dollars at it. But somewhere on the can, the number, do you remember what it was, John?
Procter & Gamble always had the moon and stars, and that was always used this one.
Yeah. And people were saying that's 666 going on there. And I think it hurt their sales of that product because it made a lot of publicity. Wow. And as you were saying, the devil is deliriously happy. Listen to all these stupid humans as they chase all these rabbits.
I've always thought that seven meant complete. So 7 years would be a complete set. 7 days in a week, it's a complete week. And 3.5 would be halfway to completion. And so 3.5 years would be halfway. You're halfway there, and you've gone halfway.
Okay, which 3.5 years were we talking about?
Well, it's just meant to be like, you've come halfway, and so now you've got just another set to go. I think that's just what I've heard in the past, and it kind of makes sense.
Were you here last week?
I was in the hospital last week.
Are you out now?
Yes. I was holding my little baby girl.
Oh, that's right. Congratulations. Well, remind me afterwards. I'm going to show you a slide up here, and I have a handout that's just for you. Okay, anybody else have any comments about these rules for interpreting Revelation? I think it's good for us to really focus on these because it keeps us from going off on wild things. Okay. Let's see if I can get the... David, guess what I did all by myself?
You pressed the enter button.
I got the map moved from one PowerPoint thing to the other PowerPoint thing all by myself. Okay. All right. Many scholars agree that there is symbolic meaning to many of the numbers that are in Revelation. And I'll let you, on your handout, I gave you what those are, which is what I'm going to give you what those are. And Homer Haley wrote a good book on Revelation, and he put in there a listing of what he thinks the numbers mean, and it made sense to me. Homer Haley was not inspired, but he was pretty smart, and he understood the Old Testament prophecies about as well as any member of the church that I've ever known. I remember one time I went to hear him in a gospel sermon, and he's preaching on the Old Testament, and he's quoting all these passages and all this kind of stuff. And I finally looked at there and realized he never had opened his Bible. And I thought, wow, how does somebody memorize 12 verses out of Zechariah without having their Bible open? It's very impressive. Well, anyway, let me give you his suggestion on what some of these numbers mean. And he gets these numbers by looking at how they're used in Revelation and how they're used in Old Testament prophecy. Again, like I tell you, some of these numbers are used in Daniel and in other Old Testament prophecies. But the number 3 seems to be symbolic of a complete and ordered whole. And when we think of the Godhead, we've got the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So there is that. Jesus was in the tomb for 3 days. Is that meaningful? Well, I don't know. But a lot of things in the Bible did happen in threes. 4 appears to be symbolic of the world or creation. And as we go through, you'll see that a lot of times as we talk about the creation and the masses in the world, many times the number 4 is associated with it. In fact, we have some things that have been passed down. Like, you know, we talk about the 4 corners of the earth. Well, are there really 4 corners of the earth? No, there aren't any corners of the earth because the earth is kind of an oblong looking thing. So there aren't any corners, but we talk about that. How many directions are there? Well, there's north, east, west, and south. There's four. So four seems to be something that sometimes symbolizes the world or creation. And it's usually not good because a lot of times it symbolizes the masses. And when it talks about the masses, it's usually talking about those people who have not accepted Jesus. Okay, and then as you mentioned, seven is a symbol of completeness or perfection. And it's used 54 times in the book of Revelation. So it appears that a number that's used 54 times is meant to convey something by God to us. And many times it conveys completeness or perfection. In fact, in chapter 1, there is something mentioned that's mentioned seven of them, and I think it probably only is referring to one, but we'll get to that maybe. Then the number 3.5 is a broken seven. So if seven is completeness and 3.5 is half of it, then 3.5 must be incompleteness. And that appears to be the case, but here's the thing about it. It's also mentioned as 42 months, which if you divide that by 12, you get 3.5 years. It's 1,260 days, which is, I figured that out. It doesn't come out to exactly 3.5 years. But if you multiply 360 days times 3.5, now what would that be? 1,260 days. You divide it. I'm tired. You divide 1,260, and what you get there is almost 3.5 years. It's off by 15 days. And then you have the term time, times, and a half time, which almost every Bible scholar says means 3.5. So now the interesting thing about that is in the Old Testament and the New Testament, when this 3.5 year period is used, it almost always refers to persecution of God's people. Almost always. It's the 3.5 years is a bad time. That's when Christians suffer. 10 is a number of completeness. It's not completeness in the same sense that 7 is, but it indicates a fullness of power. And so when you see multiples of 10, numbers that are multiples of 10, that indicates whatever power is indicated times a power, which means it's really powerful. So we'll come across that. 5 is not used very much, but 5 is half of 10. And as 10 indicates a lot of power, 5 indicates a little bit of power, a small quantity. And then 12. Haley just calls 12 a religious number. Now think about how many tribes were there originally in Israel? 12. How many apostles were there originally? 12. How many baskets of food were collected after the miracle of the loaves and the fishes? 12. Now, are all those things meaningful? I don't know. But apparently God had some interest in the number 12 and decided to have 12 tribes and to have 12 apostles. So that's something. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because around throne scenes, we often have 24 people up there. And in some of the other throne scenes, it tells us that there were 12 tribes up there. And then it says there were 12 apostles up there. Then it talks about the apostles and the prophets, 24 of them. Well, two into that is 12. So I don't know what all that means, but it is significant that that appears to refer to people who were significant in God's plan. Okay, any comments about those numbers? Okay. I'm fighting the PowerPoint here. There we go. Okay, that's the idolatry scriptures. Okay. Well, John said he was on the Isle of Patmos, and just to show David that I really did this, let's do this. There it is. Look at that, David. It's I don't believe that miracles happen today, but this is close.
Beautiful.
Okay, this is Patmos, and if I had a bigger map, you'd see it's here. And what you, everybody's familiar with Israel, where it is. Then you have Syria up here. And then up here, we're back in the first century, this was called Asia, and here's Ephesus. Well, Patmos is 62.9 miles as the crow flies from Ephesus. It's right here. And it's a little rinky-dink island. It's 5 miles by 10 miles. That's it. Very rocky, very hilly. Not a happy place to be. But it was a great place to exile Christians, because it was thought if you're stuck on Patmos, then you're in a crummy place and you're not happy. So that's where John was. And then what you see here is the Mediterranean Sea out from Israel. Up here is the Aegean Sea between what was called Asia, and here's Greece. And then this was the Adriatic Sea between Greece and Italy. And I think I got the foot on Italy pointing the wrong way. Doesn't Italy point west? I think it does. But this is symbolic. we're staying in the mode of Revelation. By the way, did anybody look at the questions that I gave you about chapter 1? Does anybody know what this is today?
The turkey.
Yes, it is turkey. Yeah, very good. So today that's turkey, if you want to know where that was. In fact, let's just see. I thought I had them here. Yeah, I do. Let's just see if you know any questions. Did anybody get one of the steps of communication from God to us as presented in chapter 1, verse 1? It's actually a fairly lengthy process. Anybody?
God from Jesus.
Yes.
To his angel.
Yes.
And then the angel to John.
Yes.
And then John to the rest of us.
Well, John to the first century Christians, and then it was recorded for us. Yeah, so that's an interesting little path, kind of a circuitous path there. But it's called the revelation of Jesus, and yet it says it came from God. And then it went to him. Three, in what sense was John the brother and fellow partaker in the tribulation relative to those to whom he was writing? Anybody have an answer for that one? Okay, let's skip that one. Next one is very interesting. What day of the week was the Lord's Day? I bet you everybody wrote down an answer, and I bet you all wrote down the same answer. What is it? Which is?
Sunday.
Now my question is, how do you know that?
Acts 20 and 7. They gathered on the first day.
Yeah. But in Revelation, it says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. That doesn't say it's the first day of the week. It doesn't say it was Sunday.
Well, Acts 27, we always look at.
That's the first day of the week. But John said he was in the Spirit, not on the first day of the week. He was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. So how do we know that was the first day of the week? How do we know it was Sunday? There's no other place in the Bible that mentions the Lord's Day like this. No other place. But all my life, and I'm not saying this is wrong, all my life I have heard, well, we're going to have Lord's Day services. We start at 9:30 and then 10:20 on the Lord's Day. And we all go, ah, it's Sunday. How do we know that? Well,
it'd be hard to argue with that.
Why?
Why would it be Tuesday?
Well, let's go to that one. The Lord's Day. The Lord's Day appears only in Revelation 1:10. It's the only place. And all my life I've been hearing about, we meet Lord's Day services. In fact, some people on their sign have Lord's Day services. And of course they mean Sunday. So nowhere in the New Testament is it stated that the Lord's Day is Sunday, but the logical assumption is that it refers to Sunday for the following reasons. Wow. That bell rings pretty fast, Jimmy. Okay. Why do we conclude that that's the case? Well, for one thing, Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday. The church was established on Pentecost, which was 50 days after Passover, which makes it Sunday. Were you all aware that Pentecost was a Sunday? I wasn't aware of that for years. And then it hit me, and I thought, why did I know that? Also, Christians observe the Lord's Supper on Sunday. Also, the collection for the saints was to occur on Sunday. So what day do we, as Christians, dedicate to the service of the Lord? Sunday. So does that qualify for calling it the Lord's Day? And I would say it's logical to conclude, yes, it does. Anybody else have any comment on that? Okay, I've always assumed, for many years of my life, I assumed there was some passage in there that said it was the Lord's Day and that's Sunday. But it's not, that passage does not exist. Okay, let's go back. We have just a few minutes, so we'll get started on chapter 1. Here is the path of the revealed prophecy. God the Father gave the message to Jesus, who it says communicated it by his angel, who revealed it to John, who bore witness to all, and also wrote it to the seven churches in Asia, and yet it was preserved for us. So 2,000 years later, we've got it by that route. And we get that from Revelations 1:1-4. That's interesting. And I got to admit, I never paid attention to that before. Now, in your chapter 1, there are two verses here that say these things. One of them says in verse 1, it talks about the things which must shortly take place. Okay? In verse 3, it says, heed the things which are written in it, which is the book of the prophecy. Heed the things which are written in the prophecy, for the time is near. Now, my question for you all is, if the things which are written must shortly take place, and the time is near, and they were encouraged, these people in Ephesus and Smyrna and so forth, to heed the things which are written in it, for the time is near, how were these comments to be understood by the first century Christians who read them? How were they to be understood? It's going to shortly take place, and the time is near.
Fixing to happen. Get ready.
Fixing to happen.
It would affect them.
How does that impact our interpretation of the things in Revelation? Very interesting, isn't it? I'm going to search for the red button.